It's time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. One thing we've noticed about running a monthly media segment in this age in history is that the topics do come fast and furious. We can try to lock up the topics a few days in advance, but the fire hose of news frequently shuffles our deck right up to the last minute. That's okay. It means there's always plenty to talk about, and that's why we've expanded it this month. We do define media very broadly. We've taken items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. Our regular guests are here from the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Andrew Gay, always good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Precious Yamaguchi, always good to see you.
Hi, hello.
Why don't we start with the most pressing and grimmest story first, which is about the Jamal Khashoggi story. I understand that is the correct pronunciation, hard G, soft G. Jamal Khashoggi, of course, a Saudi journalist who disappeared into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where he was staying at the time, and never emerged, as far as anybody can tell. It appears he has been killed. A number of media reports indicate that he was perhaps tortured and killed. So very, very tough stuff to talk about here. But this is what can happen to journalists who, and in his case, he was an opinion journalist. So he criticized the regime of his own country, and that may have led to him paying the ultimate price.
Yeah, it seems that it was 7 minutes of him being tortured and brutally killed with like bone cutting saws and all different types of screams that someone heard in terms of his torture and killing. And it seems that whether it's on social media or television, that everyone should be outraged by this type of incident happening and the way that it happened in all of its forms. But we see variations of people on social media denying their concern or denying their affiliation with him.
And you've got two forces going on in the world at the same time, fairly broadly across the world. One is the rise of authoritarian regimes. The power of the ruler in Turkey itself is greater over time, although we're really talking about, with potential culpability here, the rulers of Saudi Arabia, which is already an authoritarian system, the rise of authoritarianism in other places, and not coincidentally, the weakening of the power of journalists, both financially and in public stature.
Yeah, I think it, definitely kind of fits within a trend we're seeing worldwide. Right now, Saudi Arabia is still claiming that it was or kind of whispering that it was an interrogation gone wrong. But that doesn't seem to match the facts.
Seems like more than just an oops. Or
right, and there's rumors that there is video and audio that will reveal that. I'm kind of hopeful it doesn't get released. I think governments and those kinds of things should be looking at that. But I always hate when those kinds of media content gets leaked out on social media. I think it's just kind of an awful thing to for the family and loved ones and friends of him. I think we're seeing it in our own country. I think it's kind of been alarming, the response to the State Department's response and the White House's response has been not particularly aggressive in support of the lives of journalists and our First Amendment principles, and hope that we sort of see that expressed in democratic ways in other countries. I think that the president has compared the Saudi Arabia regime to Kavanaugh, and saying, "Oh, here we go again with the guilty until proven innocent." I doubt Kavanaugh enjoyed that comparison, but I think that it's alarming in a lot of ways.
One of the phrases that sticks out to me is continually hearing the phrase Jamal Khashoggi wrote pieces that were critical of the Saudi government, and yet he's identified as a journalist. And I think we get into this realm again where when you hear critical of the government, you think, well, oh, here's a journalist writing a hack piece or something. But the fact, he was an opinion journalist. Mm-hmm. He wrote columns for the Washington Post. And I think from my own perspective as a person who is not in the business of giving opinions, it does seem like we way too often and more over time, particularly in an age of Fox News and the like, where the idea of somebody who reports facts versus the idea of somebody who gives their opinion is completely and almost irrevocably intertwined in ways that it makes it hard hard for people to understand the role of a journalist, generally to report facts and to ask tough questions about why did this happen this way versus the people who do draw conclusions from it and state those opinions.
Right. I think, you know, in this particular case, he was sort of self-exiled from the country, you know, had claimed that Saudi Arabia had shut down his Twitter account. And so I think, you know, he definitely had an informed opinion. He was coming from it from someone who had experienced oppression in Saudi Arabia, you know, but obviously he was expressing his point of view. I think people blend these together because, you know, on the one hand, you know, I view journalism, yes, telling the truth, obviously telling facts, but also, you know, I think journalism is supposed to have some kind of an oppositional position to power because
it's an adversarial thing.
Yeah, adversarial, right? That, you know, any case, you know, I think any journalist needs to be skeptical of those in power because, you know, there's always going to be that line that whether it's a local government to the federal government to international governments, they have their line and they have interests and in what they're trying to communicate to the public. And I think the journalist's job is to be skeptical of that and to challenge that. But certainly that's different than those who are out there, you know, paid to offer their opinions, which is kind of a different thing.
And then even revealing some facts sometimes too might seem like it takes a side of revealing things that are against the government, even if it is a fact the government might not want people to know those certain facts.
Like, and that was a negative piece you wrote about the budget deficit being big.
Right.
It was a fact piece.
Yes, yes. And just that type of putting it out there could be very dangerous in this case.
All right, more to talk about the media role in the world today and some other major events coming on. We're talking about the Conners returning to TV without Roseanne, Carol Spinney, the voice of Big Bird, and Oscar the Grouch retiring, and other things going on in the world of media. In an expanded version of Signals and Noise, our media segment with Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University. You're welcome to join the conversation. We'll talk to you on the other side of this break here on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having an expanded version of Signals and Noise this month. Precious and Andrew had to change the date. We thought, you know what? Let's give this the time it often needs because we often have to clip things off at the end of Signals and Noise. So they have most of the hour with us today. Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University talking about a wide range of topics in the media. Your input is welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the Jamal Khashoggi story and then more broadly about journalists and their safety and opinion versus journalism. And so we move now into talking about USA Today a few weeks ago, publishing an op-ed under the byline of Donald Trump from the White House, riddled with falsehoods. And in fact, fact checkers went back and discovered that pretty much every sentence that was in that op-ed had a falsehood in it. And I wonder what you guys made of A, the decision to run that, and B, the decision to run it without a fact check first.
Yeah, I was thinking because when I was in grad school and I was writing for a magazine, it would get fact checked multiple times, the articles we would submit or articles other people would submit. And so I was just thinking back into that time, what would it be like if Donald Trump received his article with a bunch of red marks on it? Because that's what it would be for a person that's not president. They would have received a bunch of red marks with fact checks and sources.
Fives in my journalism
class,
the first one.
Right, yeah. And also I think that we should pay attention to the media outlet that he chose to run his article or his opinion in, the USA Today versus maybe like Washington Post or New York Times. And So I think that a lot of it has to do with him being the president, and you can't just like send an article back with a bunch of marks on it.
Well, and let me look at some of the things that were in here. For example, factcheck.org took about three times the space that the president took to fact check what he said. But things like he said that Democrats want Medicare for all. They do not all want that. He talked about how Democrats want open borders. Democrats want to model America's economy after Venezuela. These are just some of the claims.
Yeah, I you know, this goes back to what we were talking about before about the difference between, you know, journalism and opinion, and obviously newspapers publish both. And I think any editor who received an op-ed from the president, you know, who knows if he wrote it himself. I imagine he had a little bit of help, but they're going to run it. You know, that's I think that in and of itself is newsworthy. The president has written a statement. But the question is it responsible to publish it without some kind of commentary, some kind of
which USA context? Today does all the time. Even with their own editorials, they will provide the opposing viewpoint connected to it.
Right. And I think, you know, as you said, there's a difference between opinion and factual journalism. But I think just because you publish opinions doesn't mean that you should allow people to publish lies. I mean, I think there's, you know, you can have opinions. There's certainly things that are subjective and are debatable points of view, but you know there. I think USA Today did a disservice to their readers and to a lot of other people who will hear statements from that op-ed who don't even read the original piece by not giving it some context. And I think this happens a lot, right? I think a lot of news outlets will report things that Trump says with a headline. You know, the president says this. But doesn't actually tell the reader whether this statement is true or false in the headline. And I think people, you know, I think it's just been the way sort of people have always reported on major political figures and the claims they make. But with someone like our current president who plays relatively loose with facts, I think it would be pretty important to start not just being that delivery system of his pure statements, but giving that context.
Precious, I'm curious about your response to USA Today just in general. We're from different generations. USA Today always had sort of a middle-of-the-road feeling for me, but I wonder where you view it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's a newspaper that you pay to buy off of the newsstand. You tend to look at it, or people tend to look at it if it's free in their hotel room or at their dentist's office.
Exactly.
And in his writing, he was using a certain type of fear tactic or kind of paranoia strategy for a particular age group, too. I think seniors and perhaps elderly people who might not go onto the internet and double check some of the facts.
We have an extended version of Signals and Noise in progress here on the Jefferson Exchange with Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University. You can contribute some topics yourself if we're not hitting one of the ones you'd like to talk about. We have extra time this time around. 800-838-3760 to join by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, let's get away from political stuff for a moment. And, I'm trying to talk about the Conners, which is the was the show called Roseanne on ABC, which, of course, Roseanne got removed from because of her political statements. But this is an interesting thing that the show was forced to return to TV. So I will say this much, that they had to remove the Roseanne character from the show. And as not surprisingly, they did so through a death. It's a very relevant kind of death to our time. I'll say that much without spoiling it completely. But I wonder what you guys made of, if whether you watched the show or whether you at least watched the ratings and made something, made some assessments about the return of it.
Well, I have not seen the episode yet. I tuned in for the original Roseanne the relaunch of Roseanne last year. I watched a couple of episodes to see what it was about,
which is a big ratings winner.
Yeah, it was a huge ratings winner, and you know, not surprisingly, the show is about working class white family that sort of definitely plugs into a large kind of subgroup of the population that is maybe not always represented in sitcom television. But I have not seen it yet. The reviews have been great. I think it got like a 95% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. You know, the critics have been sort of split. You know, some people saying, you know, that you really feel Roseanne's absence. Others saying, actually, without Roseanne sucking out all the oxygen in the room, the rest of the cast is really flourishing. You know, it's interesting because, you know, the original Roseanne ended its run by revealing that Dan had died. And of course, then it nevertheless was resuscitated, and Dan was alive.
Right. And now, he was resuscitated. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Why do people keep thinking I'm dead? He says right, in the first episode of the reboot.
And now Rosie's dead. And so you know who knows? Will that last? One of the cast members already said, "Well, you know, we won't. You know, you never say never. You know, maybe she'll come back in flashbacks or so. You know, who knows what will happen." You know, she's obviously a controversial figure. She spoiled her death. We've actually known for a while, and she did tweet with you know, an expletive, but I'm not dead. Just letting everyone know. So you know, she is supportive of the cast and crew, but has made no bones about the fact that she is not happy with the choice of being out of the show.
I feel that it's positive, at least for the cast and crew, that their jobs can continue to go on, especially working a bit with Andrew and seeing how cinema and television go. I can see that there's so much work that goes into a crew. And
a lot of people who work.
Yeah, a lot of people that are depending on it and preparing for it. So I'm happy in that way for all of those people that they're able to continue with their work.
Okay, elsewhere in entertainment in the media in this month's Signals and Noise, Big Bird stepping down actually today. Let's play that clip of Big Bird from years ago.
Abkadefki Jekyllmanopquistuwixes. It's the most remarkable word I've ever seen. Abkadefki Jekyllmanopquistuwixes. I wish I knew exactly what I mean.
If you're trying to figure out what he was saying, it's the alphabet said yeah. as a word. Abkadefki, Jekyllmanopqu. Yeah, okay, but take it from there. So, Carol Spinney, I did not realize had been doing the voice of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch since Sesame Street debuted in 1969, and I hadn't been doing the puppetry for a few years, but still doing the voices. And as of today, steps down at age 84. This is a big transition.
Oh yeah, I love looking at the photos of when he first started to do it. Doing the Big Bird voice, and just such two opposite voices. One that is so friendly and inviting to everybody, and then you have Oscar the Grouch, who just wants to be by himself and everything and annoys him, but he does each of them so well. So I'm so sad that we'll no longer be able to enjoy those voices.
It wasn't until yesterday morning that I knew that Oscar was also voiced by Carol Spinney. I knew Carol Spinney had been Big Bird for a long time, but didn't realize also did the voice of Oscar the Grouch. And so the probably the happiest, peppiest creature on the show versus the grungiest, nastiest one.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a Muppet obsessive, and you know, Big Bird was one of my early favorites. I used to have, I don't know what it's called. It's not a rocking horse, but one of those kind of rocking horse type things on springs. That was a giant Big Bird that I used to ride on as a kid, and I had, you know, giant Big Bird stuffed animals. I loved Big Bird. One of my favorite movies as a kid was Follow That Bird, which was the feature length Big Bird movie. And actually, one of my pick threes early today is I Am Big Bird, a documentary about the life of Carol Spinney, and it's a really
from 2015.
And it's a beautiful documentary, and it's very touching. You know, he seems to be, you know, obviously don't know him personally, but from the documentary, definitely got the impression of a really amazing person. What's interesting about Big Bird is that character has evolved quite a bit from the early age. You know, that clip you played was an early Big Bird song.
You're not going to tell me Big Bird's been smoking and drinking in recent
years,
are you?
Well, you know, Big Bird's original character was sort of a dummy. So it was just kind of this, you know, dim-witted bird. But then they, over time, you know, Sesame Street is very steeped in research. They really do a lot of research about early childhood learning and how they develop characters. And over time, they realized that wasn't necessarily the best way to represent this point of view. And instead, Big Bird became the four-year-old. Big Bird's character is this lovable four-year-old who's just curious and excited and wants to learn. So still, you know, obviously not informed on all things, but no longer the dummy. It's more of a, I'm curious and I don't know what's going on. Tell me about things.
Well, that's a smart adjustment, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was amazed about was just the physical difficulties of performing as Big Bird, and I'm surprised Carol Spinney was able to do this until I guess he was 81. But but the fact that to do Big Bird, it's not like you're behind the scenery working a puppet and able to interact with your actors on that level. Big Bird is a self-contained island of costume, and in order to work the mouth and the eyes, Carol Spinney had to have his hand over his head for as long as they were shooting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would say, well, come on, the head only weighs 4.5 pounds. He said, you try standing like this with 4.5 pounds above your head for half an hour.
And there's like a little TV in his suit so that he can see.
Because he couldn't see anything really otherwise. Yeah.
I loved when he also traveled to China when I was little. I remember that was super memorable to see him traveling internationally.
And Barclay.
Wow. And I did get a chance to look at the trailer for I Am Big Bird, which you just recommended for us to watch. And Carol Spinney, a very, very complicated guy, very, very down on himself, it sounds like, early in his career, but persevered and wow, really made a career out of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. This is Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi. You can join us at 800-838-3760 to comment on the topics we're talking about or add one of your own, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about social media just a bit. There's a story yesterday, I guess, about Facebook overstating its video statistics. Apparently, it overestimated the time that users spent watching clips by something like 60% to 80%. I understand a lot of advertisers have made decisions on whether or not to use online video based on the numbers they were getting from Facebook. So a market has been shifted because numbers were not correct.
Yeah, and I don't think that this is overall particularly new in terms of advertising and Facebook. There's been other research and articles that had to do with the way in which people, who's counting views or how people are getting views in order to influence the advertising space on Facebook. But the idea that our email address is affiliated with Facebook that we might not particularly think are the ones that are directly affiliated with Facebook and out there in the public, they are
the actual Facebook email addresses.
Yes, they are attracting different type of advertising opportunities that we're not aware of.
Wow. As if Facebook didn't have enough black eyes already. It's running out of eyes.
Yeah, this was kind of news I didn't want to hear, you know, because I teach video production, and obviously, all the reports of everything's video, everybody's watching video, this is good for me, this is good for the market. But so this was kind of in some ways disappointing news just in general that we've been misled about this. But, you know, I think it's had a huge impact on news outlets. I mean, there's been story after story over the past couple years about news outlets shedding, kind of firing print journalists or journalists who write and replacing it with video. And, you know, I kind of wondered because I don't, you know, I consume a lot of news, but I very rarely watch a lot of news video content. I prefer to read it. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of, you know, I've been skeptical somewhat of these moves. And now we have kind of that bears out that maybe these reports weren't quite true. I think obviously people do view media content, video content, but it'll be interesting to see how accurate the numbers are going forward.
It's interesting to watch though how pervasive video becomes, and this is you're talking to somebody who spent 30 years in the video business, but the fact that there are some websites you can't go to and get away from the video. Mm-hmm. It's in a big box on top of the page, and if you scroll, then it shifts to a smaller box in the corner of the page, but it's never
right
off of there.
And then sometimes there are multiple videos popping up at once. It's kind of maddening, and I hate the audio, the autoplay videos.
The way that we've been trained too, we get used to the idea like, okay, you can click through this this preview video, this ad will be, you can click away from this ad in 5 seconds, or you get the ones that say your video will run after this ad, and then you're just sitting there watching the countdown, 15,
and
14.
At the same time, it's almost like we expect everything that we're interested in to have a video, like whether it's a product that you are thinking of purchasing or a person, you almost expect it to have a video now too. So I could see why there's videos all over, but
it always cracks me up because I love to watch movie trailers, and it always cracks me up that to go see a commercial right on YouTube, I have to first watch the commercial. So there's always this, before I can watch the new trailer to Whatever film's coming out, I have to watch this other commercial for Swiffer or something.
We will show you your ad as soon as you are done watching this ad.
Yeah, exactly. I think, my perspective of it is that, video content is important. And we talk a lot about the fact that I think almost any career now, you need to have some ability to use video. I think most organizations do use video to communicate, but it's certainly possible that we've overblown the importance, right? That there's a place for it, but it's not necessarily the end-all, be-all of communication, and there's all these other ways that people like to receive their information.
Well, and then, okay, so
like the radio.
Right. Well, self-revelation, though. After we did the State Senate Candidates Forum last Thursday, and then RVTV finished its edited video version and put it up. I looked for an embed code and found it. And sure enough, put it up there so you can actually watch it on our website as well as listen to it. So we'll hear, I'm sure, during the course of this fun drive what people thought of that.
Right.
Speaking of which, as we head to a break with Precious and Andrew, I want to remind you that we are in fun to drive mode here at JPR. It is day one. It's really just the first few hours of our fun drive. And we are shooting for $175,000 in pledges and 350 new members. We're off to a good start. And we can give thanks to Pat Herdklotz in Ashland. An anonymous pledge from Ashland, another one from Cave Junction. Charles McClure in Coos Bay says, this has been his default radio station since he came off the road and had to keep a list of local NPR stations to tune the radio as he long-haul trucked across the country. Thank you for that pledge, Charles. Melissa Van Skoyak in Sawyer's Bar, great to hear from you. Leonard Milbure in Coos Bay and Catherine Henderson in Ashland. All thank yous for the first hours of the Fall Fund Drive. Get on the list. Put in a pledge of support. Public radio stays on the air because people like you pledge financial support to keep it going. 888-552-6191, 888-552-6191, or you can pledge online at ijpr.org. Back with Precious and Andrew and more Signals and Noise in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you again for listening. And we are in the midst of an extended version of Signals and Noise, our monthly perusal of the media landscape. There's always a lot to talk about. I always feel like I'm jamming Precious and Andrew into a fairly small box. And so we've given them more time this time around. So Signals and Noise has had a chance to spread out and go a little wall to wall for a change. We're more than just an area rug this month as we discuss the media. And it's media everything from online video to books. You can join the conversation with your thoughts about what we've talked about or offer a topic of your own. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. You can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Bill, let's see, no town given, wants us to know that Big Bird was actually a bit of a slang term dating back to the 1860s. To get the Big Bird, actors would get the Big Bird was to be hissed at. To be criticized by the gods, I guess. Theatrical slang, he says, from John Camden Hotten, Piccadilly, 1867. This is the slang dictionary. So.
Wow.
Interesting.
So there you go.
Get the
Big Bird. Yeah. How
did
things go for you? Oh, I got
info.
The Big Bird out there tonight. It wasn't a good thing in the days before Sesame Street. So thank you, Big Bird, for changing that around. And let us take a phone call from Al in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. This is Signals and Noise.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, I'm just wondering, you know, in the media, especially in the United States, when it comes to Israel, you don't see any even-handedness. You'll see the denial of the crime that it's committing. Just last Friday, six Palestinians were killed and hundreds were injured trying to get out of the biggest boxcar in the world called Gaza. And I don't And being the political, where you have the U.S. voted about 50 or 60 resolutions, the $3.8 billion a year from our tax money goes there, and there is no even-handedness or any objectivity when it comes to Israel crime against the Palestinians. I'd like to hear your guests what they say about that.
All right, so uneven treatment of Israel versus Palestinians in the media, and Precious wants to weigh in first.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, I agree with him. There's a lot of things that we miss in international news, and not just in terms of Israel, but even like in Nicaragua, there's a whole uprising and rioting right now that sometimes you just really have to look for these different news articles and outlets. And it's really hard because journalists, they do have a concern about their safety, revealing so many different things or being able to take video and photographs. And I would say that being in different countries or having like studied or worked or lived in different countries, I felt so bad that so many countries know what's happening in our news, whether it's about the fires or Kevin Spacey or all these different things. In the United States, people have knowledge, but then we in the United States miss so many things that are so important around the world. And sometimes it has to do with a certain story in our country just having so much attention, or just that we don't receive the reports or have the reporters out in all these different locations. So it's really a shame. I agree that we need to have more of international news highlighted amongst television, newspapers, and so on.
Yeah, and I think I agree with Precious, and I think a lot of our international news gets covered purely from the perspective of what political leaders are saying about it, right? And so, you know, right now we have an administration that is very pro-Israel. So we hear a lot about that perspective. You know, Obama famously had a very tense relationship with the Prime Minister of Israel. And so we, you know, during that administration, I think we heard a lot of you know, criticism from conservative critics saying, oh, we're always, why is the liberal media always, promoting this particular perspective? So I think it, unfortunately, we're so obsessed with our own politics that I think we don't necessarily get a lot of reporting of what's actually happening in the world. We just get reporting of what our leaders are saying about those events.
Yeah, I was aware of that, I think, before I even met with a news director from Hong Kong about a job in the 90s. And he was, this was like early on in trying to get into places like Vietnam. And he was sending a crew from Hong Kong to Vietnam, and it was going to be a big deal. But he said, we're going to cover what goes on in Vietnam, not what happens to people in Hong Kong and Vietnam. He said, we're not introverted like American media. We don't just cover the effects
right,
on Americans.
Yeah.
And so big difference. And honestly, to this day, when I want to know what the rest of the world is thinking, I'll check out a British paper. I'll go to scmp.com, the South China Morning Post, just to see what somebody in another part of the world, in an English language organ, sees us as doing.
Yeah, and when I taught media literacy, I would often do a section where I would pull up the homepage of a bunch of different news organizations, everything from Fox News and CNN to Al Jazeera and BBC, and the BBC. And it was always kind of eye-opening for students to see how different news coverage is in other areas. Whereas, honestly, between Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC, there's actually much more in common than between the American media and Al Jazeera and BBC. In one case, in the American media, it was much more, again, politics and celebrity. And you were actually seeing mostly about world conflict and major, situations happening around the globe and the other two.
I was a little surprised, though, to be honest. We were sitting in the departure lounge at Heathrow coming back from vacation, and the BBC newscast at noon was on. And rather than lead with, some major shakeup on Brexit or, what was going on with the Chequers plan or any of that, they led with a young woman who had died of a food allergy from eating at a Pret-a-Manger. And it was, this is 5 minute, they were doing the breaking news stuff on the bottom of the screen, just like Fox News and CNN, about stuff that had actually happened days before.
Wow.
The Pret-a-Manger hadn't really been rigorous enough in warning people about the allergy stuff in there. I thought, BBC's going to this too?
We're having an impact everywhere.
Right. Yeah, well, American news value is getting exported. Final thing I want to bring up here, which is about, it's a political thing again, but it certainly gets into the media zone because of the way in which Elizabeth Warren chose to present to the world, the fact that she had taken a DNA test in the hope that President Trump would A, stop calling her Pocahontas, and B, give $1 million to a charity of her choice.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Warren. Is Dr. Bustamante in, please?
Hi, I'm Carlos Bustamante, and I've advised companies in the direct-to-consumer space, including Ancestry.com, 23andMe, and Helix. In the senator's genome, we did find 5 segments of Native American ancestry with very high confidence, where we believe the error rate is less than 1 in 1,000.
Now, the president likes to call my mom a liar. What do the facts say?
The facts suggest that you
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
So it could be 6 to 10 generations ago, but an American, a Native American ancestor somewhere in her line. There's been a lot of criticism, not just for the, again, the somewhat contrived media format. You know, hi, is the doctor there? Well, of course he's there. There's a camera in his office. You knew this. But also I've seen the criticism, whether this is political or media based, that Elizabeth Warren chose to play Donald Trump's game. Mm. And nobody wins on that field.
Yeah, it's really disturbing to watch him call her Pocahontas and other people to make a mockery of different Native American nations. My graduate school mentor, she and I wrote together, and she was Cherokee. And one of the things that we wrote about together was how she herself felt that her heritage was really, really important to her, but she was also could passed for being a white person. She had blue eyes and lighter skin. And then it was the opposite for me, whereas I am fifth generation Japanese American, but at that same university, I would be mistaken for an international student. And so there's a real fallacy, I think, in thinking that people of a certain heritage or ethnicity or culture should look a certain way, like if you are Native American, that you should be like Pocahontas, or that you're light-skinned and light-haired, blue eyes, that you can't be of a certain culture, ethnicity.
Yeah, at the same time, you know, obviously, you know, the Cherokee Nation came out with a pretty scathing critique of Elizabeth Warren pulling this approach. I was disappointed because I think, one, it was so predictably a bad call. Like, to me, I kind of wish I could be in the room of the people who sat around this table and thought, here's what we'll do. This will be, yeah, this will win the message.
What would your advice have been?
Well, it would have been like, no, this is really a stupid idea. One, because now you're letting your opponent, the president in this case, win by playing that game.
Yep.
And two, there are numerous voices in the Native American community who could have told them that this is going to be alienating, that this is going to be insulting to them. You know, one, that, you know, these DNA tests are, you know, I think it's somewhat of a misuse of the DNA because, of course, you're comparing to a bunch of other people who have claimed certain heritage. And so that's not how Native communities define themselves. You know, tribal membership is about a lot more. You know, it's about kinship. It's about cultural identification. And, you know, the fact that she didn't consult with tribal leaders before making this decision, I think, was just a boneheaded media move to me. I think it was just such, and so I think she deserves the backlash a little bit, just not even from a political standpoint, just from a media messaging standpoint. That was such, to me, such a poorly executed plan.
All right, that was exactly why I made sure that we were talking about this in a media context.
Exactly.
As well. Yeah. Why don't we move into our pick threes as we round out the signals and noise segment for this month. And Andrew, you already gave us one with I Am Big Bird.
Yes, I Am Big Bird, as I said. I definitely recommend that documentary. I just watched the latest season of BoJack Horseman, which I think continues to be one of the most bold writing, television writing series. You know, there's
it's a washed up cartoon.
Yeah,
horse.
And there's literally an episode that the entire episode is just one scene of a horse giving a eulogy. And it is amazing. So I just can't recommend BoJack Horseman enough if you want to see some really different television. And then the other is a viral video of by Lindsay Lab, a young woman who plays ukulele and sings a song that she wrote called "A Scary Time." And it is about, you know, ostensibly about what a scary time it is to be a man in America today, but with a twist. And so I highly recommend this video. I think she was on Kimmel or something the other night because she got so many viewers that it got the interest of the
national
media.
Okay, the Me Too backlash is what produces
right,
this.
Right, exactly.
The idea that, like,
it's very funny song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Precious, on that note, let's move to Precious for your pick three.
I was really excited during our Ashland World Film Week this past couple of weeks. The Cake Maker was a great film. It was an Israeli-German film by Opir Raal Grazier. Really, really excellent film. And I enjoyed watching Saturday Night Live's Pete Davidson's response to the guest host, Kanye West, when he did his rant on Donald Trump the following week.
He had
a response, which was really funny. And I hope his humor is not overshadowed by his breakup with Ariana Grande.
They broke up?
Yeah.
They're so far behind.
And also, I chose The Ghost of Tsushima for PlayStation 4. Amazing, amazing animation and storytelling for a video game.
All right. I love the way you keep us up on video games. They're just great. And that it comes from Precious and not from Andrew. Yeah. Thank you so much. Once again, it's always great to have you guys for Signals and Noise, and I'm glad we had a chance to stretch our wings a little bit this time, and fill it out. Okay. Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University, our monthly guests, co-hosts, really, for a segment we call Signals and Noise. Great to have you.